These are the stories I think you should know about today. 30 people a day are arrested in the UK. 30 people a day arrested for what they think, for what they say, for what they write. We've got the latest. Germany's not too far behind, by the way. They just arrested an 84-year-old man for something he posted on Twitter. And what about John Bolton? The most hawkish, the most pro-war, the most pro-violence American who lied the world into the Iraq War. Should he be arrested? What did he actually do? I'm gonna tell you. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to ask you a question that's affecting millions of people all of a sudden all over the world, and hey, it could affect you. The question is, should you be arrested for what you say, for what you send, for what you write, for what you post? There seems to be no place in the world right now where this question is more prominent than in the UK. Look at this headline. People there are being arrested at 30 per day. 30 people every day visited by the police in their homes, in their workplace, because they said something or they published something the government doesn't like or simply doesn't agree with. It's all part of something called Section 127 of the Communications Act that describes the crime as a, quote, malicious communication. And what the hell is a malicious communication? I guess we're all guilty of that once in a while, right? It's a message that causes someone else to be annoyed, causes an annoyance, an inconvenience, or anxiety to others via the internet or a telephone or mail. And who gets to decide? Who gets to choose? What's an annoyance? What's an annoyance to me may not be an annoyance to you or to somebody else. What's an inconvenience? Man, talk about Orwellian. You know who decides? The government. Look at this chart. What it shows here is that more and more people are now being arrested with each passing year. 7,000 in 2019, 7,000 plus, actually, almost 8,000. Now 12,000 plus in 2023. That's up 58%. And they were arrested for expressing their thoughts. How can that be, right? Well, guess what? It be. People are being jailed for criticizing the government's position on Ukraine, on Israel, on immigration, even parochial stuff, like criticizing your local government, your mayor, your councilman, or even your kid's school. Take the case of Maxie and Rosalind. Here they are. They don't exactly look like hardened criminals, do they? At least not to me. But here's what happened to them. Their children go to a nearby school, right, which Maxie and Rosalind criticized. Did they violently confront the administration? Did they show up at the school with a gun, a weapon, a knife? No. They questioned the school's policy on choosing headmasters, and they did so in a private chat with other parents on WhatsApp. You know, the WhatsApp app. WhatsApp app. That's it. That's all they did. So here's what happened. The school doesn't like what they said, so they call the police, and they report them. Suddenly, six uniformed police officers from the Hertfordshire Police Department show up, they raid their home, and they arrest them. They're driven away, and they're put in a jail cell for 8 hours. Parents! There, they're questioned on suspicion of malicious communications. Again, whatever the hell that means. And after a five-week investigation, their case is finally adjudicated. Bloody hell. All right, and it's not just the UK. That's what you need to know about. It's not just the UK. I'm going to tell you about a guy named Jürgen Todenhofer. He's a respected German author who was just arrested himself. His crime? He criticized Benjamin Netanyahu in Germany. There it is. There's the headline in the Telegraph. German police arrest author over tweets concerning criticizing Netanyahu. Not only do most people around the world agree with what he posted, many, even in Israel, have actually said what he posted. Here's what the 84-year-old founder of the Justice Party wrote on X that got him in trouble. Quote, Mr. Netanyahu, does your conscience never actually protest when you do to Palestinians the same thing that the cursed Nazis did to the Jews. Now, you notice what he's doing there, right? You notice he calls the Nazis cursed Nazis. That means he's condemning the Nazis, as well as Mr. Netanyahu. I say that because you may know that there are still some laws on the books in Germany that forbid people from trivializing the Nazis or speaking well of the Nazis, but he's clearly not doing that, by the way. Yet police still confiscated his phones, they took all his digital devices, and they arrested the guy, 84 years old. Again, the majority of people all over the world agree with Mr. Todenhofer. But even if they didn't, let's say they didn't, even if he was saying something worse, something really outlandish, or something stupid, or something cruel, I'd still defend his right to say it. Why? Well, because, well, I'm a journalist. Free speech means free. It doesn't mean free sometimes. It doesn't mean it's free only if we agree with you. No. It means you have the right to be wrong. You have the right to be stupid. You even have the right to be mean. Take the case of John Bolton. Here's the headline. John Bolton indicted over the handling of classified information. Now, when I saw this, I was ready to defend John Bolton. Not because I think he's an honorable person. I think he's despicable. I think he's a horrible person. But my gut reaction was to defend him because I know he's a ruthless critic of Donald Trump. He says horrible things about Donald Trump. And if Mr. Trump was simply getting revenge against him, and that was what the prosecution was all about, that would be wrong. And it's my duty as a person, more especially as a journalist, to say that. But I've done a little research, and it turns out that after questioning more, I've changed my mind. I was wrong. It does appear that Bolton actually did commit a crime here. Here's what he's being accused of. New York Times, 18-count indictment accuses Mr. Bolton of sending diary notes about his day-to-day activities as Mr. Trump's national security advisor from 2018 to 2019. Many of these notes included national defense information, including details that are classified and top secret. So here's what he was doing. He was leaking, writing these memos every single day to his wife and his daughter, leaking classified information on Google Mail in a non-protected way, thereby potentially revealing these daily secrets that he was pulling out of the White House, sending to his wife and his daughter so they can help him write a book. But these secrets could have been seen by other countries. All they had to do was go to something that was unprotected, like Gmail. And by the way, the investigation didn't start with Trump. The investigation of Bolton started during the Biden administration. So maybe it's not Trump's revenge. Here's something else you should know, by the way, and I think this is important. You know what Bolton said about somebody accused of something similar? Maybe even not so similar, because I think it's much less. Here's what Bolton said about Edward Snowden, who did not publish documents to make money off of a book like Bolton.
The last thing that people ought to be doing is speculating about it publicly. It will inevitably make it a political football, and it will enhance Snowden's bargaining power.
Why are they doing it then? Why at least are some of them doing it?
I think it's a big mistake. I have no idea. I mean, my view is that Snowden committed treason. He ought to be convicted of that, and then he ought to swing from a tall oak tree.
Swing from a tall oak tree. They ought to kill him. Bolton, on somebody who's doing what he's now accused of. Just saying. Here's what Bolton said about Julian Assange, who simply reported on news of U.S. atrocities in Iraq.
Well, I think that's a small amount of the sentence he actually deserves. He's committed clear criminal activity. He's no more a journalist than the chair I'm sitting on. The information that he divulged did, in fact, put many people in jeopardy. It undercut the ability of the United States to have confidential diplomatic communications, not just with other foreign governments, but in many countries with dissidents, people who, even speaking to American diplomats, could find themselves in trouble. And so, you know, he's been complaining about his treatment over the past period of time. He's the one who sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy. Now he faces extradition to the United States. I presume he will get due process in the United Kingdom. to determine whether extradition should go forward. And when he gets to the United States, he'll get due process here. And I hope he gets at least 176 years in jail for what he did.
176 years in jail. So if you divulge secrets from the United States government, you should get 176 years in jail. You're a traitor. You're despicable, his words, right? You should be hung from the highest oak tree for revealing these government secrets and these classified information documents. Makes one wonder, right? When we consider now John Bolton's crime and John Bolton's punishment, which is exactly what we're going to do. After a short break, I'm going to be joined right here in the studio by none other than the Larry Johnson. I feel like I'm talking about Ohio State or something. Former CIA analyst and perfect guest to talk us through this. He knows a little few things about intel and information that should or should not be divulged. Stay right there. We're going to be right back with Larry Johnson. He spent many years at the CIA, and now he's probably one of the best-known truth-tellers in the entire world when it comes to the alternative media, the places where people like you and I get most of our information these days, because forget about trying to get it out of the corporate media. He is Larry Johnson. He is to my right, and it's such a pleasure to have him here once
again. My friend,
yes. How are you, Larry?
Thank you.
Good to see you. What made you get started to be such a truth teller? You know, I'm sure as a CIA guy, I mean, you work for the U.S. government, you could have just a really nice, cushy retirement, sit on your ass, play golf, and do nothing.
Well, I didn't actually retire. I spent 4 years at CIA, then 4 years at state counterterrorism. Whatever you want to call my media career as a truth teller, to Carlos the Jackal.
Wow.
So when he was captured in August of 1994, CNN, your old outfit, I don't know if you remember Pat Reep. Pat was the scheduler there. Mm-hmm. Well, his brother, Joe, was the press spokesman in the CT office. And I just left the office. And so Pat calls Joe up and says, hey, do you know anybody who can talk about this? He goes, Larry Johnson, he's available. And boom, the rest is history.
That was your first television appearance. And since then, you've never looked back.
Correct. Well, I gave good soundbite.
But you could never appear on CNN right now. They wouldn't have you.
They stopped having me. My last appearance on CNN was in 2017 with Brian Stelter to talk about the FBI spying on Trump, and where I talked about that, that in fact, it was British MI6, mm-hmm. British intelligence, was, and they're passing it to the CIA. And then he accused me. He says, well, you go on RT. You're just a puppet of Putin. And I pointed out to him, I said, hey, Brian, look. I said, I've done CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, CBS, ABC, BBC, CBC, all the C's. And I said, and with all of that, the only one that's ever asked me for a pre-interview, or with all the others,
right?
RT?
No.
Never.
Did I call you today and tell you we had to stick to a certain script or what we had to talk about?
If you
missed a call?
No idea what we were going to talk about. no idea. But it was the fact that when I pointed out to him, I said, look, all these other stations do pre-interviews because they want to know what you're going to say so they know whether they want to have you on air. Mm. I started doing RT, well, now 9 years ago, I think.
Right.
And never in 9-year period have they called to say, what are you going to say?
Right.
Because we may not like it. I can come on, I can be critical of President Putin. And I've been critical in the past.
Yeah,
but
as you should be.
They allow it. And so what does it say that we've come to this time where the free press is in Russia, the controlled press, that which used to be, we used to, like in the Soviet days, we'd made fun of Pravda and TASS and Sputnik. That was in the Soviet-controlled Russia. That's now the UK and Washington, D.C.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
By the way, in case you guys at home don't know, when he says pre-interview, I can tell you a little bit about this because I used to be a part of it. If I was going to appear on CNN, first somebody would call me and ask me 7 or 8 questions. And if I didn't give the right response, they would then call me a half hour later and say, oh, sorry, we have breaking news. We can't do the interview.
Oh, we've decided to go in a different direction.
We've gone a different direction. Exactly. That means we don't like what you're going to say, which is terrible. I mean, talk about censorship. Damn.
You know, I used from 1994, I did probably 18 appearances on Crossfire on CNN.
Yeah. When Tucker was there.
Yeah, well, yeah. Before Tucker, even Bill Press, Geraldine Ferraro, Pat Buchanan.
Pat Buchanan. Yeah. What a character.
And then I was on ABC News Nightline with Ted Koppel probably at least 12 times.
Great man.
I was on the Jim Lehrer News Hour. I was a NBC terrorism expert. I was a Fox News paid analyst for a year.
Back then.
Yeah. But now.
Now they won't touch you.
Oh, no. The first case was in 2008 when I said some bad things about Barack Obama, suggesting that some of his ties to radicals like Bill Ayer is a terrorist who was convicted in the United States.
And even if you were full of crap, so what?
Yeah, yeah.
So what?
Tell me I'm wrong.
Right. And you know, and don't call me names. Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me how I'm wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so important.
So, but this exchange, and you know, like right now, I'm in Russia with the International Unity Club. I'm speaking to a variety of Russians, of significant people, even the former Azarov, the former prime minister of Ukraine. And there's no control. I'm not told what to say.
No, we should exchange ideas with other countries.
The conversation. Let's talk, not fight.
You know, it's funny we're talking about this because there's one person who's in the news today. I don't know if you heard my intro, but I was talking about John Bolton.
Yeah.
Now, John Bolton is just the opposite of you. They love John Bolton at CNN. They can't get enough of John Bolton. They have John Bolton on 3 or 4 times a day sometimes because John Bolton gives them exactly what they want to hear. What do you make of the fact that John Bolton is now possibly facing a prison sentence? And from what I have been able to decipher, based on the information that I've read from media reports, nothing inside, I think he's guilty as hell.
I think karma is a beautiful thing. You know, Bolton.
I dated her once.
Yeah.
Karma.
Bolton was a neighbor of mine when I lived in Bethesda, Maryland. I was on Burning Tree Road. You go 2 blocks up Burning Tree Road, take a right-hand turn on Bradley Boulevard, go a half block, take a left-hand turn. His house was right there on the right. Mm. And he was a disgraceful human being.
Yeah.
And part of that is based upon one of my friends who was the National Intelligence Officer for Latin America was being pressured by Bolton during the first Trump administration to provide false information. Or maybe it was under George H.W. Bush or George W. Bush. But to provide false information about Cuba. And my friend refused to do it. He says, I'm giving you the intelligence as we have it, whether you like it or not. Bolton then had him investigated by the FBI. They tried to pin him as a Cuban spy. They were opening his mail, violating his privacy. Bolton is a monster. And so now he's getting a taste of his own medicine. I hope he likes it.
Do you think there's any question that if he actually was concluding a meeting with Mr. Trump and the national security team, and then immediately going over to his computer and sending notes fresh from his mind about everything that was discussed, sending it by Gmail or by other non-secure ways to his wife and his daughter, sounds to me like a case.
Yeah. Yeah. If that communication was classified, you know, and he took obligations. But again, he was not loyal to the United States. He was loyal to John Bolton and Bolton's own agenda and unwilling to play by those rules. So, you know, I don't think this is a cavalier case that was just ginned up. They had, I think, solid evidence that he was using some classified. It wasn't just he was reporting the contents of the meeting. Mm. Reporting what Trump said in a meeting may or may not necessarily be classified, but if he was drawing upon other documents that were, and it wouldn't surprise me that he did.
It seems that Bolton may be gone from the Trump administration, but there are other Boltons there now.
Yeah.
Some of this palaver that's being discussed now about a full execution of a war or an invasion of some sort against Venezuela seems not just foolhardy, but absolutely dystopian, absolutely crazy. And what a coincidence. It happens to be one of the countries with the most natural resources of hydrocarbons in the entire world.
Right. Well, and now they're also hitting Colombia. What disturbs me so much is that the journalists in the United States, nobody has pushed back on Trump when they destroyed, you know, they've destroyed now 5 boats.
Yeah.
The first one was a 60-foot cigarette boat with 4 outboard mortars, supposedly carrying drugs from Venezuela to the United States. Well, I did some very simple calculations. Those four outboard motors suck up gas at a rate that that boat can only travel 250 miles before you have to refuel it. Well, the distance to the United States is 1,300 miles.
Yes.
Okay, so that means they were going to have to refuel it at least another four times. The amount of fuel required to put gas in those engines would be 40 jerry cans per service, which means you're looking close to 300 jerry cans, 5-gallon jerry cans. Well, you stack those into a boat, along with 11 people, where do you put the drugs?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so the rules of engagement, I spent 23 years involved with scripting military exercises for U.S. Special Operations Forces. And every one of those exercises had rules of engagement. I have never seen in conventional or special operations where they were given the rule of engagement that if you think they look like a bad guy, shoot them.
Blow it up.
Blow it up, kill them.
Yeah.
Never. There was always that if they pointed a weapon at you,
right,
or if they were threatening to kill you with the means to do so, yes, then you could kill them. But here's Trump killing somebody on, well, we think.
So why do you think they made that order, and who made that order? And how could it have been? I imagine you could just put a helicopter out there and follow the boat and see where he's going, and then have somebody stop when he runs out of gas. Why would you have to blow him up?
This was a military order that was written up, passed up through the Joint Chiefs of Staff, signed off by Pete Hegseth, probably signed off by Donald Trump. And there are generals and colonels in that process that, as they saw that, they should have resigned. Now, in fact, the head of Southcom, a fellow who just took over about 6 months ago, he's resigned. So I think he resigned. In fact, New York Times reported he resigned in part because he objected to what was being done.
Who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff right now? What did he do?
Kane.
Shouldn't it come across his desk?
Yes.
That the U.S. military was about to be used to blow up a fishing boat?
Yeah. He would have
to approve them.
Yeah. This is one where these people in this chain of command needed to say, wait a second, this is an unlawful order.
And it's not our job.
I
would think, right? Am I wrong to say the U.S. military shouldn't be doing police stuff?
That's exactly right. What they can assist. So I spoke with a Coast Guard former officer who had been involved with several of these missions.
Yeah.
And he says, you stop the boat and you try to take the people on board. Now, when you stop the boat, if they start shooting at you, then yes, you can shoot
back. Of course, defending yourself.
If they're posing a direct attack on a U.S. vessel or U.S. personnel, of course you can shoot back. But more often than not, what they did, they were able to capture them, take possession of the drugs, but more importantly, you've got the people so you can question them to find out who's your chain of command?
Yes.
Who's running? So you can take the organization apart. Oh, no. We're blowing it up. This is all a pretext. This is all to create a justification for the United States to conduct a military operation against Venezuela, one for regime change, two to secure access to the oil and natural gas.
I actually understand and have been reading in the last few days about this, and I've learned that the organization that we're accusing the Venezuelan government of being involved with is actually a CIA organization.
Yeah.
It was started by the CIA. They founded the damn thing.
Well, at least, they didn't appear in any of the media until 2018. And because when I first heard about it, I was the senior regional analyst for Latin America, or for South America when I was at CIA. And I've done a lot of, investigations and work with my own company, Berger Associates, in Colombia, in Venezuela, in Panama, and Ecuador. And we dealt with a lot of drug issues because my two former partners, one was the chief of international ops for DEA, and the other ran DEA's undercover money laundering operations in New York City. Mm-hmm. So we knew all about the money and the sourcing. Never heard of Tren de Aragua. Mm-hmm. And when you start looking into it, it was in 2018 where Donald Trump starts talking about regime change in Venezuela. And lo and behold, articles start appearing in Peru, Argentina, talking about Tren de Aragua. Well, the way that works is the CIA creates this storyline, this narrative, and feeds it out there. Now, there may very well have been a criminal organization in Venezuela, Tren de Aragua, but they were taken and they were magnified and they were created into an entity that wasn't really doing what the U.S. government is saying that it's doing.
That's fascinating. Let's talk about Iraq. I mean, pardon me, Ukraine. I get those two mixed up sometimes. But we do have to talk about Ukraine because there's a lot of news coming out of Ukraine.
Yeah.
Obviously, the fact that Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump are going to be getting together. What do you make of this particular summit, as they're calling it, this time around? With particular interest to the fact that it's being held this time in what I consider to be a more neutral or friendly site.
Sure.
I thought Alaska was a disaster.
Well, the Trump team needs to learn to listen to President Putin, Sergei Lavrov, Peskov, the rest of the Russian government. On June 14th, 2024, Vladimir Putin made it very clear what the Russian position was at the time, which means recognize that Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Crimea, that those are now permanently part of the Russian Republic.
Mm-hmm.
They're a part of the Federal Republic. They're not going back. They're constitutionally part of Russia. And, you know, just as Scott was with you yesterday making the same point, Putin can't up and say, oh, okay, let's forget about it. Yeah, we'll keep Donetsk and Luhansk, and we'll let you have half of Zaporizhia.
The other ones we liberated, we're going to give them back to you, right?
Okay, not going to happen.
Right.
So, and the fact that the Ukrainian troops must pull out of Russian territory. Vladimir Putin, I believe what he says. He's not going to make concessions on that. The storyline being pushed in the West that, oh, there can be these concessions, not going to happen.
Mm.
So ideally, what happens is that the dialogue that is started between Putin and Trump continues, but they talk about some actual substantive things, like number one, let's have direct flights again between the United States and Russia, you know, back and forth.
Mm.
Let's establish who our new ambassadors are. So we want ambassadors in each other's capital that are going to be able to communicate to the government
right.
on a regular basis.
Right.
I remember I had a brief conversation in December of 2023 with the deputy foreign minister, Sergei Rybakov. And he lamented at the time, he says, look, we don't have anybody to talk to. And we discussed the fact that even during, you know, I'm an old guy, so I can remember the Cold War.
Yeah.
Even during the 1970s, when here was the Soviet Union supplying weapons to Vietnam that were killing Americans,
mm-hmm.
still America and the Soviets talked. And they even negotiated arms control agreements.
Yeah.
But here in 2023, we weren't talking. Now the good news is we're talking. The other issue is let's return the property that the U.S. government illegally took from Russia under Barack
Assets
Obama.
Assets frozen that are now giving some of the interest from.
So
to...
they can talk about that. But as far as ending the war in Ukraine, I think Vladimir Putin's position would be quite clear. You, the United States, need to stop supplying intelligence, money, and material to Ukraine.
You can't end the war in Ukraine until you end the war between the United States and Russia. Am I wrong?
No, you're correct. And, you know, I've made the point repeatedly that if the script was flipped, that if Russia was providing weapons to groups in Mexico or Canada that were then launching attacks across border
right.
into the United States would view that as an immediate act of war, and we would have tensions on the cusp of a nuclear threshold. Now, to Putin's credit, and I know he's come in for criticism of this in Russia, but he recognizes, number one, that Russia, the trajectory they're on, they will win in Ukraine. They will prevail. NATO will be defeated.
Do you think so?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Someone give me a couple of $1 million, I'll bet that right away. Okay. No, but
it's good money.
They're going to be defeated. They are defeated. They're a dead man walking. They have no way to recover. But at the same time, President Putin and the general staff and the foreign ministry is, you know, it's just not one guy making the decision.
Right.
They're looking at this in a broader context that ultimately they would like to get back to some normal relationships with the West if possible. But right now they are extending and working with the East.
Mm.
And this new world, there is a new world financial, political, economic order emerging out of the BRICS nations.
But let's go back to what we were just talking about, because I think that's almost crucial, if not essential, to this. And I'm wondering what Zelensky and the Ukrainians and maybe even some of the folks in Western Europe would think about this. If Mr. Trump just said, I am going to equal the playing field. Mm-hmm. We, the United States of America, are going to be neutral. We don't sanction you, Ukraine, but we sanction Russia. From now on, we're going to sanction no one. We give weapons to you, Ukraine, but we don't give them to Russia. From now on, we're going to give weapons to no one. This is going to be an even playing field. The war's over the next day,
yes.
I would think.
Well, this war continues because of the Ukrainian oligarchs who started making money in major ways with the start of the Maidan back in 2014. Mm-hmm. So the funding by George Soros that started in 2004, 2005, funding from USAID, it kept increasing. They were purchasing supporters that then became the leaders in the Maidan. And at that time, CIA money was flowing in, money from MI6. But the oligarchs were the ones who were setting up these different ways to rip off and rob the state. And in the process, they were taking money from the United States and money from the Europeans. And it's getting, Rick, it's getting kicked back. I know there are 23 members of the U.S. Congress right now that are under investigation for, I'll tell you off camera the names, but yeah. One of them's got $16 million and one of them got $23
million. So money that came from U.S. taxpayers to Ukraine ended up going to the oligarchs, and then some of it got funneled back to the people who voted for them to get the money.
Correct.
Is what you're saying.
Yes, and a lot of it has gone through banks in the Baltic states. And gee, remember that company called Burisma?
Yeah.
And in Burisma, there was Hunter Biden as a board member, but there's also a guy named Kofor Black. Kofor Black was a CIA officer. He'd been head of the Counterterrorism Center. He was also the head of my old office at State. He was the ambassador at large for counterterrorism.
Huh.
And he was also on the board of a Lithuanian bank, or maybe it was Latvian. I forget this particular country. And the reason they selected him is he was, quote, an expert to prevent terrorist financing, terrorist money laundering. Within 2 years after he's on the board, that bank was sanctioned for being involved with cycling money. So, you know, this money trail is there.
Let's talk about the difference between the two countries, because I think this is important. My estimation, and I'll share it with you, and you tell me if I'm full of crap. Seems to me like after 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the same thing that you just described that is taking place in Ukraine was taking place here.
Yes.
A lot of very powerful, rich jagoffs, bad people, ended up making a lot of decisions, and they turned this place, what used to be the Soviet Union, which is now Moscow, Russia, et cetera, into a bad place where crime was horrible, corruption was horrible. It was a bit of a mess in many ways. And credit where credit is due, Mr. Putin and some others stepped in and said, okay, no more of this. I know you guys have got a lot of money. That's great. You got a yacht. You got this. You got that. It's over. From now on, you got to pay the piper. And Russia changed.
Yes.
And Russia today, I don't have to say it. I think you see it walking the streets of Moscow.
Yeah.
It's an amazing place.
Yeah, no, that's it. I think the meeting that Putin held with the oligarchs, it was either July of 2001 or July of 2002. I forget which year. I'm sure he remembers and they remember. But, you know, he made a
Some of them got kicked out. They just said, get the hell out of here.
Well, he made a very
And you
clear,
can't take your money with you.
You're going to stop robbing the state.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can make money, pay your taxes, stay out of politics, which would be a good thing if we could have that in the United States. But as a result, as you correctly note, that completely diverted Russia from the path that Ukraine has followed.
Exactly. I was just going to say, the second part of my enthymeme is that never happened in Ukraine.
Correct.
So those bad people who used to run Russia and the bad people who used to run Ukraine, in Russia, most of those people are gone. Of course, there's still corruption. There's still some bad people. But in Ukraine, they're running the show.
Yeah, I mean...
Or are they?
I mean... No, absolutely. In fact, I did an interview with one of the former Ukrainian prosecutors today. And, you know, he ultimately had to flee here to Russia for safety.
Really?
But he went through in detail the different scams. So, like, these oligarchs... They would go in and they would just buy a company, except the people who owned the company were never informed that it was being purchased. They wake up the next morning and you don't own the company anymore. And so they would file in court legal action, And then by the time they got a decision, the people that had stolen the company in the first place had sold it to a different person. So they were constantly chasing it from a legal standpoint. Or they would set up front companies that were going to be paid to do certain work, except the front companies existed only on paper.
So those people are still hanging on in Ukraine.
Yes.
They're the ones who are ruling the roost and telling Zelensky what to do?
Correct.
Really?
Yeah. And he's, you know, I mean, he's getting paid to do it. This is his best. It's his best paid acting job yet. You know, and it's like, we'll pay a lot of money and it's all the drugs you can use. And he's going, this doesn't sound so bad. But now he's realized he's made a deal with the devil.
Yeah.
Because he can't get out alive.
Well, he can't be happy with the way he was treated by Mr. Trump in the last 48, 72 hours, whenever that took place over the weekend. You know, Mr. Trump told him in no uncertain terms, you're going to lose territory. Of course, Trump called it property because he's a real estate guy. And now he finds out that Trump is flying to, of all places, Hungary to have this meeting with Mr. Putin. I mean, you know, as Mr. Trump would say, the cards are not in his favor right now.
Correct. Yeah, well, he doesn't hold any Trump cards. You know, it would be one thing, you know, they've been pushing to get the Tomahawk missiles. And I realize, one of the things I've learned this week, across the board in Russia, there's genuine concern about if the United States deployed those Tomahawks.
That'd be horrible.
That would be seen as crossing a red line, a genuine red line. Now, I tried to provide some reassurance that the Tomahawk is... There was a time when it could carry a nuclear warhead, but those were dismantled under the INF treaty, and we've seen no evidence that the United States has tried to reverse that process. So what you wind up with is about a 300-pound of explosive on a cruise missile that travels subsonic speed.
Heading toward Moscow?
Well, no, they could do pinpoint damage.
Yeah.
You know, it could blow some windows out in the Kremlin, for example. It could take out Lenin's tomb. But it doesn't accomplish anything militarily. A good military analyst in the United States who's of Russian heritage, he did an analysis the other day of one of the major refineries in Russia and pointed out it would take 100 cruise missiles to destroy that one refinery.
Really?
Destroy it. Well, the United States doesn't have 100, Tomahawks.
Yeah.
And so that's the problem.
Do you believe Mr. Trump when he says we just don't have them to give to you?
Or, oh, absolutely.
Really?
They're both true. Finally telling the truth.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at this entire panoply of U.S. weaponry, Patriot missiles as an example, Lockheed Martin makes between 550 and 700 a year. Not a day, not a week, not a month, a year.
And how many has Zelensky taken and used?
Well,
probably a good portion.
Consider this. When you've got an inbound, let's say you've got an inbound Iskander missile from Russia, Ukraine's going to have to fire 4 Patriot missiles to try to take down that Iskander, and they won't be able to because the Iskander can evade them. Each one of those missiles costs $7 million.
Gosh!
Now, I guarantee you, the Iskander doesn't cost $28 million.
Right.
So here's Zelensky shooting off 4 to try to take it down. Well, we've seen, look... we've had several days in a row where Russia's shooting between missiles and drones 600 a day, 800 a day, 700 a day. Let's just assume you fire 2 Patriot missiles for each one of those. In one day with 800, you've shot 1,600 Patriot missiles. That's 5 years of production.
By the way, as bad as that scenario is, the way you paint it, I've also just read recently that there have been close to 300,000 desertions in the Ukrainian army. Meanwhile, the Russian military is recruiting quite healthily, and people are happily signing up to serve.
Yeah.
What does that tell you?
Yeah, the morale problem on the Ukraine side is desperate, as are the casualties. We've seen, you know, since start of January in 2025, when the government of Russia, government of Ukraine, agreed to exchange the bodies of dead soldiers.
Yeah.
It's worked out to an average that for every dead Russian soldier returned to the control of the Russian government, Russia is turning back 35 to 45 dead Ukrainians.
Wow. Now, 40-1 odds.
Yes. Now, here's where we get into this interesting analytical contradiction. On the one hand, Western analysts, you know, General Ben Hodges, General David Petraeus, General Jack Keane, Admiral Stavridis, they're all saying, oh, Russia's doing really bad. They're barely making any progress. It's really slow on the front. And then when you point out those odds of bodies, they say, well, the reason that's happening is the Russians are moving so fast that the Ukrainians don't have time to recover the bodies. And you go, okay, which is it? Is it slow?
Or is it fast?
Fast. pick one. Pick one or the other, but you can't have both.
That's a great point. Let's switch over to Gaza and that disastrous situation. Obviously, we saw that just a few days after the peace deal was announced, it's already been broken.
Right.
And the Israelis are saying now they have a right to go in there and re-attack, which they have. Yep. What do you make of that?
Well, when we saw the peace deal, the alleged peace deal at Sharm el-Sheikh, you had Donald Trump, you had all the guests, you know, like a wedding. You know, you had the Europeans, and you had the Gulf Arabs, and you had a couple of Muslim nations, the Turks and the Indonesians. You didn't have a bride and groom, okay?
Right.
There wasn't the Gaza bride and the Israeli groom.
It's like the in-laws decided to...
Yeah, so we're going to have a wedding ceremony, except there's nobody to exchange vows.
Yeah.
So as soon as you saw that, you knew it was a hoax.
Yeah.
And I wrote about that on my blog at Sonar 21. And I said, you know, this is a hoax, and based upon the history of previous ceasefires, you know, at best this will last a year. Well, it didn't even make it 3 weeks.
What do you make of this announcement by Jared Kushner, for example, that he is very excited about the possibility of turning that whole region, because it's a waterfront property, into a wonderful new place, sans, sure, of course, the Palestinians.
Yeah, that's what they want to do. It's, you know, the term ignorance is bliss.
Yeah.
So he's very happy about it.
What's he admitting to by saying that?
Yeah, well, that they're going to help expedite the Zionist settlers' movement into Gaza. But the problem they face is Hamas is not going to disarm. And despite all of Trump's tough talk about, oh, we're going to force them to disarm, Israel's been trying for 2 years now, more than 2 years, to disarm Hamas. And let's, again, step back at it and look at it from a military standpoint. Mm. Israel had every military advantage an attacking force could have. They had this, I'll call them the enemy, confined to an area that was about 5 miles deep, 20, 25 miles long. So they had the enemy contained. Mm. They had the blockage of the ocean side. They had artillery, tanks, armored vehicle, fixed-wing aircraft, rotary-wing aircraft, overhead intelligence support from the United States. And all, what did Hamas have? They had some rifles.
Yeah.
They had a few mortars. They had some RPGs. They may have had two or three heavy machine guns and some sniper rifles. That's it. They fought Israel to a standstill over 2 years. Hmm. So, you know, we hear the criticism of the, you know, the alleged Russian slowness. Russia took back Bakhmut and was fighting a NATO peer.
Yeah.
They were fighting an army that was equipped and armed by NATO with advanced weaponry. And they took Avdiivka and Bakhmut after, yeah, you know, 6 months, 8 months, they took it. Here we have Israel with more than 24 months now, and again, every advantage. They're not fighting a peer military, anything but they're fighting an insurgent force, and Israel can't beat them.
Yeah.
Israel can't disarm them.
Do you worry, final question, because I know you've got a plane to catch pretty soon, to go back to America, our,
yep,
country. Do you think it's inevitable that we're going to face another situation in a warlike state, at least, I don't even know what to call it anymore, between Israel, Iran, and the United States?
It's possible, but I think it's going to be averted because of Russia and China, the actions that they have taken, and Iran's willingness to finally ask for help.
So they've emboldened Iran to the point where it's not so easy to mess with.
Well, correct. You know, Iran, in my view, foolishly, prior to the attack that took place on June 13th, had basically, you know, you're old enough to remember the Excedrin ad where ad, mother, please, I'd rather do it myself.
Yeah, exactly.
That was Iran. You know, here was Russia and China offering help, and Iran was saying, you know, please, we'll do it on our own. We're quite capable.
Yeah, well, maybe not.
Well, then they experienced Israel's surprise attack, and Iran effectively fought back and put a real hurt on Israel. But they came out of that realizing, you know what? We get, as George Ringo, as Ringo Starr sang, I get by with a little help from my friends. And they've tightened the relationships. You've seen frequent visits of Iranian officials. Defense Minister Ali Al-Arjani has been up here. The same with China. China and Russia have been sending military flights in with, I presume, air defense systems,
yep,
personnel capable of helping train. So I think
changes the game.
It does. And if there's anybody with sanity left, and there are still some sane and Israeli intelligence officers, that they can look at that picture and realize, you know what? We're getting ready to pick a fight with a grizzly bear that we don't have the running shoes on to outrun. Yeah.
Larry, what a pleasure. You're such a good person. My wife is a fan, by the way.
Oh, well.
She asked me the other day when she saw you at the Bolshoi, she said, you know, he's a really nice guy. She said, is he from the South? I said, no, I don't think so.
A border state, Missouri.
Show me, damn it.
Yes, sir.
No wonder you are the way you are. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much.
You're a good man and a good friend, and I thank you so much for visiting us and sharing your wisdom with us. Let's do this. Let's go to our mailbag. And we're going to begin today with Peterman, who writes to us. You know, it's ironic that the home of George Orwell is now the most anti-free speech country in the world. An Orwellian prediction has come to pass in the UK itself. And you know what else, Mr. Peterman? In countries that used to or not allow free speech, they now have more free speech, as my friend Larry said just a little while ago. Who knew, right? Sam Phillips says, thanks, Rick, for your voice of sanity. I'm trying, Sam. But man, I got to tell you, it seems the world is less and less sane with each passing day. And then there's Boyd Floyd. Great name. I love the rhyme. He says, look, I've been watching your career for years now, and I'm so glad that you've decided to join RT for actual journalism rather than the pseudo-journalism. How's that for a cool word? Pseudo-journalism, where conjecture is headlined. What a breath of fresh air in an environment of lies and agendas. That's really nice, Mr. Boyd. Thank you so much for saying that. So here we go. If you have thoughts to share, go to my YouTube podcast, Journalistically Speaking. Don't hold back. Let me know what you like. Let me know what you don't like. It's all good. I'm also on X, of course, Rick Sanchez TV. And there, man, tens of thousands of you every day are letting me know what you think. And I really appreciate it. Most of all, I appreciate you guys letting us into your home. Have a good night. God bless. Take care. Bye-bye.